Welcome back to 40A&M in 5, a download of 40A&M LLC, recorded at 1700 Eastern on Sunday, November 3rd. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector-related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, Facebook earnings surge in the third quarter. AT&T is reportedly on the verge of making big moves for an increased presence in Europe. Bloomberg reports that Verizon may aim to take over Intel's content delivery initiative. The U.S. Senate confirms Tom Wheeler as new SEC chairman. Adobe reveals more about the hack that recently impacted its source codes and customer data. U.S. tech companies get aggressive to rein in NSA surveillance methods as draft legislation is developed on Capitol Hill. And two sets of remarks in Washington this week by top European data protection officials highlight the difficult road ahead for transatlantic privacy, despite even the best commercial intentions. But first, the third quarter of 2013 proved a charm for social media giant Facebook. Reporting a 60% increase in revenue, Facebook made $2.02 billion in the third quarter, with revenue from advertising accounting for a sizable percentage of that amount, or $1.8 billion. This marks a 66% increase in advertising revenues for Facebook, primarily attributable to mobile ads. Facebook's third quarter net profit of $425 million compares to a loss of $59 million for the same quarter of last year. As reported by the BBC, which covered Facebook Chief Financial Officer David Ebersman's conference call on the earnings, Facebook's statistics show that use of the social media platform by teens is pretty stable, with perhaps a dip in use by younger teens. Overall, market analysts are conscious of the desire by Facebook that it not be seen to be suddenly not cool among the younger demographic. Since July, shares of Facebook have nearly doubled, which is when the firm announced its most recent surge in advertising revenue. Facebook now says that roughly 874 million of its more than 1 billion users access the social media site from their mobile device, one of the reasons that CEO Zuckerberg called Facebook a mobile company in a recent conference call. As reported by the BBC, Google is still by far the online advertising leader, accounting for nearly half of all mobile ad spending in the U.S. Both Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal reported last week that AT&T may be organizing itself to make a pitch for Vodafone as early as in 2014. AT&T Chief Executive Randall Stephenson had signaled in recent months his interest to acquire a mobile network operator in Europe, a potential growth market for expansion for AT&T, even when it's facing strong competition at home in the U.S. According to Bloomberg, while formal discussions between the companies have not occurred, AT&T is thinking about what parts of an acquired Vodafone might be retained and what sold. The Bloomberg story cites that Vodafone's European operations are most attractive to AT&T in a potential deal, where mobile broadband adoption has long lagged the U.S., and that the U.K. operator, Everything Everywhere, or EE as it's called, might be another potential alternative. One potential strategy cited by Bloomberg would be for AT&T to spin off most of Vodafone's emerging market assets into a new entity that could be acquired by a single buyer. But as noted by the Wall Street Journal on October 31st, the impact of the NSA surveillance revelations may create unexpected hurdles for the company and other similarly situated U.S. companies seeking greater markets in Europe, where outcry over the surveillance has been fervent. And even without NSA controversy, an AT&T purchase of a large European telecommunications company would face a likely complex mix of reviews in Brussels and EU member states. Although Bloomberg has noted that the UK, where Vodafone is headquartered, does not have a clear takeover law mechanism, which would prevent the government to block a foreign deal if it was so inclined. In related news, Bloomberg has reported that Intel is said to be in talks to have Verizon take over its own effort to deliver internet television. According to Bloomberg, Intel, under new management, has decided to scale back its participation in the venture earlier this year to focus on existing business, particularly sales of smartphone chips. Verizon, Bloomberg reports, has been seeking methods to deliver more of its Fios video through pathways beyond its own fiber optic network, such as wireless and more typical over-the-internet delivery. Intel has been at work on its own content delivery efforts since 2012, an initiative designed to give customers access to content seamlessly across TV, smartphones, and other mobile devices with live programming and video on demand. Tom Wheeler, President Obama's pick to be the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission in the U.S., was confirmed last Tuesday night by the U.S. Senate, with his swearing-in expected to take place in Washington early this week. As several outlets have reported, the incoming chairman, who has worked as both a cable and wireless company advocate in recent past, had to pledge to Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, that he would not strengthen campaign advertising finance reporting requirements as a priority for his new agenda before Senator Cruz would allow his colleagues to vote on his confirmation. That hurdle overcome, Chairman Wheeler is expected to helm an FCC that has a bevy of critical issues before it, including incentive auctions for the reassignment of broadcast radio spectrum, what to do if a poor decision comes down from the D.C. Circuit on the Commission's net neutrality rules, ambitious plans to deliver greater internet connectivity to libraries in the U.S., and regulatory reforms that could either help or hinder transition in some parts of the U.S. to IP-delivered telecommunications. Since Adobe confirmed a recent cyber attack on its servers, the scope of the hack has increased, with the firm now confirming that usernames and passwords may have been stolen for up to 38 million of its active users. Adobe also believes that a number of passwords on dormant accounts may also have been compromised. In May of this year, Adobe had shifted some of its products and services to a subscription model, requiring customers to register for an online account and to provide payment details in order to qualify for upgrades. Adobe had earlier released that the hack had accessed the source code for its Acrobat PDF document and editing software, as well as its Cold Fusion web application, but has since added that the source code to Photoshop, its industry-standard photo editing program, may have been compromised as well. Adobe has, since the hack, reset passwords on all impacted users as a precaution, and it still believes that the encrypted credit card details and debit card numbers and other customer order details had only been accessed for the accounts of the original 2.9 million users revealed to be impacted. For months, a number of tech companies in the U.S. have been voicing the need for greater transparency around U.S. intelligence community requests for telecommunications data, but little more. As of last week, a number of these companies are now demanding strong substantive new restraints on how the NSA collects and uses the breadth of information it collects, not only from the data streams of these U.S. tech companies, but also from around the globe. Six of these companies, Facebook, Google, Apple, Yahoo, Microsoft, and AOL, delivered a letter on Thursday to key members of both the Senate and the House, endorsing a bill that lawmakers had sponsored to end the bulk collection of phone records, exemplified by the June 5th revealed FISA court order regarding Verizon. The legislation, as suggested by President Obama in his August 9th press conference on potential intelligence reforms, would also create a privacy advocate position to represent liberties and rights issues before the FISA court. The stance taken by U.S. tech companies may have grown more aggressive this week, in part due to the most recent revelation that the NSA has been engaged in the collection of user information from Google and Yahoo as it moves among its overseas data centers, essentially hacking these data center streams directly, which has led some companies to refocus on hardening networks against infiltration, according to the Washington Post's November 1st story on the tech letter to Congress. Even as this aggressive push by tech companies emerges, corporate, civil liberties, and some congressional critics have been harsh with their assessment of competing legislation introduced this week by Senators Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, and Saxby Chambliss, Republican of Georgia, Chair and Vice Chair, respectively, of the Senate Intelligence Committee. This bill, to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, would codify limitations that the FISA court has placed on NSA use of information of the type that is gathered in recent past. But it would also seal in law the expansive powers that have been claimed by the NSA to date, including the freedom to continue the harvesting of email metadata. According to the Washington Post, Senate committee staff dispute that the bill has this intent, But as experts have pointed out, the fact that the bill amends the business records provision of the FISA, but neither authorizes nor prohibits the email dragnet of metadata, implicitly leaves it open for the Justice Department to continue its interpretation that the metadata is subject to access. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, and member of the Intelligence Committee, as well as privacy advocates, are also concerned that the text, absent what any new safeguards or other controls, would largely codify in law the room for the FISA court to interpret NSA surveillance methods expansively. Julian Sanchez, a senior research fellow to the conservative Cato Institute, told the Washington Post that the best-case scenario is that the bill locks in and authorizes the current conduct. But the worst-case scenario is that it gives them an argument to expand. Even as these legislative developments were occurring this week, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's foreign policy advisor, Christoph Husgen, and Secret Service Coordinator Günter Heiss were reportedly meeting with U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and Lisa Monaco, Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. The aim of the meeting requested by Germany was in part to get to the bottom of U.S. intelligence hacking of the Chancellor's mobile phone, which reportedly had occurred for more than a decade. More on these developments in the coming week. On Tuesday, October 29th, U.S. Federal Trade Commissioner Julie Brill and member of the European Parliament Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who is member of the German Greens Party and rapporteur for privacy and data protection in the Parliament's Libe Committee, addressed a packed auditorium of the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. for a 90-minute event sponsored by the European Institute. Commissioner Brill's remarks were perhaps the most vigorous defense heard to date of U.S. efforts to police compliance with the U.S. EU Safe Harbor Data Protection Program. Negotiated in 2001-2002 as a means for U.S. companies to certify that they were in compliance with a set of principles from the EU's tough privacy rules, the safe harbor has come under most recent scrutiny given surveillance revelations. In terms that were once both passionate and lawyerly, Commissioner Brill stated that although the Snowden leaks may, in our best mutual interests, serve as a catalyst for long overdue change with regard to surveillance, the events also highlight the distinctions between national security and commercial uses of data, and the Federal Trade Commission's remit is, of course, the latter. In the course of prosecuting this remit, Commissioner Brill encouraged her European colleagues and consumer privacy organizations to raise concerns and any substantive leads to the FTC that should be enforced under Safe Harbor. To that end, she added, the FTC follows all leads, including those it develops on its own, bringing 10 cases since 2009, and prosecuting Google, Facebook, MySpace, among others, and required new compliance processes and audits for up to 20 years for some infractions. She also noted that a consent decree with Google had resulted in $22.5 million in civil penalties. Commissioner Brill also emphasized that for the Parliament to focus on ending or reopening the safe harbor would be folly, as Europe, like the U.S., does not blend compliance with privacy rules for national security and commercial interests, the target of safe harbor, under the same authority. When it comes to safe harbor, she added, we are the cop on the beat, and the actions we take under our authority build trust day in and day out. Jan-Philipp Albrecht, member of the European Parliament, emphasized that the Libe Committee's approval only a week earlier of a vast new regulatory reform of European data protection rules was a long overdue step forward toward a true single market for privacy in the European Union, which had been hobbled for over 15 years of disparate national rules implementing the prior EU directive. In the context of Europe's outrage over the surveillance revelations, Mr. Albrecht was careful to point out that the Parliament's action shouldn't be seen as a lack of trust and respect for the FTC, but as a concern regarding the U.S. legal environment, which, in Mr. Albrecht's terms, has privacy completely subservient to issues in national security. He added that issues of balance, national security interests with fundamental rights to privacy, are our problem as well in the EU, but that our privacy laws, as he put it, begin from a different fundamental. But it was in answering a question regarding the EU's draft regulation that Mr. Albrecht seemed to get the most palpable response among the audience. Mr. Albrecht was asked about the draft's Article 43A, which by its words requires the permission of the relevant EU data protection authority before a transfer of European personal data could be made to a third country's law enforcement. How could this be complied with? Wouldn't the requirement essentially end the safe harbor arrangement? And how would European regulators deal with the costs and manpower of so many new requests? Were just a few of the points raised. Mr. Albrecht responded that this language, in 43A, does nothing more than restate a requirement that was already there under the current Data Protection Directive, adding that if you look at this language today and are thinking that it, having the approval of the regulator for transfers, is something new, then it calls into question whether your actions to date, in any respect, have been legal. If your transfers were valid before, then they will be valid in the future, he added. But what this answer did, as well as the uncomfortable shifting in the seats that could be seen among the many U.S. attorneys in the room, was to underscore both a clever tactic by Parliament and seldom noted difference between European and U.S. legal environments. Whereas U.S. lawyers will most often see new words and rightly esteem new requirements, the same cannot always be said in Europe. True, U.S. companies collecting and processing data from European citizens must do so under the imprimatur of filings and relationships with the European data protection authorities, or via the safe harbor. But to have that imprimatur stated in such succinct terms, embodying what might otherwise seem to be a case-by-case reporting requirement, arguably does have far greater meaning. Mr. Albrecht said that he recognized that how the U.S. and Europe deal with surveillance and access to data will also be crucial for shared goals that we have internationally. We don't, for instance, he said, have a majority at the ITU. And if we throw fundamental values such as this overboard, he added, it does damage to our shared goals in environments such as this. When asked if he felt that the finalization of the EU regulation might be extended beyond the expected close of May deadline before parliamentary elections, Mr. Albrecht was firm. We have been deliberating now for 3 years, he said, and the current concerns do not change for Europe what are fundamentals that pre-existed this debate. You also have to remember that the national security issues in Europe are ultimately under the competency of member states in the EU. To put off finalization in view of potentially addressing these issues, even in our own markets, would not do any good. May is a very good date, he said. If we need to build coalitions for further work and remake consensus, we will be thinking about 2017-18 at the earliest, and that is far too late. The day after this event of the European Institute, European Commission Vice President and Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding spoke at a conference organized in Washington largely focused on advancing the EU-US Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. Her remarks singled out that data protection is an issue that could easily derail the TTIP. As for Europeans, it is, in her words, non-negotiable. In her remarks before the European Institute, Commissioner Brill noted that the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had recently found an avenue for European citizens to seek redress under the U.S. Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Commissioner Reding took this a step further, expecting a U.S. Privacy Act that provided judicial redress to European citizens, regardless of their residence. But it was the context of Commissioner Viviane Reding's speech, her seeking to advance the cause of economic growth in the context of EU-US trade, which helped to underscore that the road toward a May vote on Europe's draft regulation, what may become of the controversial Article 43A, and what impact that may have on US-EU safe harbor, cannot, despite a very real and hardened expectation of the US, be shaped in a vacuum that ignores potential trade implications for both sides of the Atlantic. You have been listening to 40A&M in 5, a production of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from Bloomberg, The Washington Post, the BBC, and The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for joining us again today. 40A&M in 5 will be back with you next week on Monday, November 11th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.